Over to John 5:17. John 5:17. This is the account of a crippled man who had been crippled for about 38 years by the pool of Bethesda. That's my Brooklynese. By that pool that starts with a B, Bethesda. He had been there for 38 years, and Jesus had come by, and he healed him. And after he healed him, the Pharisees were quite upset about it. It's around John 5:17. And they criticized him. They yelled at the man, particularly because it was the Sabbath and that Jesus healed him on this day. And Jesus' response is interesting because he said to them, "My Father is always working to this very day. And I, too, am working." And that's so true. That's what God's holy days are about. God's holy days are rich in meaning. They're deeply significant. They're magnificent illustrations illuminating the work that he is doing here on earth and in the universe. And that work that he's continuing to do to bring humanity back home. It's a work of restoration, as Rick Shaby talked about, when you think about it and you boil it down. A work, when completed, will bring every human to a place he's always yearned for and always desired, deep in his heart and soul. We all desire it, and sometimes many people don't even know why they desire it and why they want it. But we all want the same thing, to live in a place of peace, to live in harmony and joy together. Each and every person, in a utopia, in paradise. Every government system that exists is designed to bring utopia and peace, and everyone fails. They all have their own way of bringing it about. You know, socialism, the old joke. When will that ever work? And the answer is next time. Because it never does work. Neither will our government or kingdoms or dictatorships, but everybody still desires and wants peace. Back in the 60s, in the late 60s, I don't really remember that time. I don't think I was alive back then. Robin Weber was, and John and others. Gordon down here, there he is. All right, I was alive, but I was a mere little whippersnapper. But back in the 60s in America and in many places around the world, people were struggling with social unrest, and they still do today. At the time, the Vietnam War was raging on, and many of our young, vibrant men were overseas shedding their blood for things that they didn't understand and know why. And there was social unrest. There were people marching in the streets. There was racial unrest, social unrest. There was revolution on the campuses, sit-ins at colleges. Just a lot of turmoil in the land. Bob Dylan was one of the singers back then, and he wrote a song, "The Times, They Are Changing." He wrote, "Come gather round, children, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters above you have grown. And accept it soon that you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times, they are changing." And they were. People wanted peace. They had enough of this war. They had enough of these riots. They had enough of the turmoil and the tax and inflation that was raging. They wanted peace. They wanted a better way, because the way things were, it just wasn't doing it for them and for the world. The songs were, "All We Are Saying Is Give Peace a Chance." Remember that. "All You Need Is Love. Love Is All You Need." That was the mantra. Those are nice sentiments. Those are nice thoughts, even scriptural in their foundation. All you need is love. On August 1969, there was a music festival that took place on Max Yasgur's farm in Bethel, New York, 40 miles southwest of the town they call Woodstock. You've all heard of it. It was billed as an Aquarian exposition. 3 days of peace and music and love. How could you beat that? How could you not want to be a part of that? The tickets were $18 for a 3-day pass. Today's, that's about $130 to $170. They expected 50,000 people to show up. Oh, and 50,000 people showed up. And another 450,000 people showed up also. They didn't expect that. And soon, the gates were falling down. The fences were coming down. They couldn't control the crowds. And they said, hey, it's free. You want to come? Come. No charge. And people came from all over the country and even from other countries. They took trains. Some walked. Many of them were thumbing rides, hitchhiking down the road, and hopping on old beat-up Volkswagen buses and other Beetles and jalopies to get there. It backed up so much they were parked for miles and miles down the roads on the side of the highways. They couldn't get close. But they got in, and it was free. Joni Mitchell, a famous singer-songwriter of the time and still famous today, you probably know her, wrote a song about that festival, which Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, another famous band. You're all saying, who are these people? I know. They made that song famous. Woodstock, it was called. You've heard it. It spoke of a desire to go back to simpler times, a time of hope and a time of peace. And she wrote, and I dreamed I saw the bomber jet planes riding shotgun in the sky, turning into butterflies above our nation. We are stardust. We are golden. But we're caught in the devil's bargain. And we've got to get ourselves back to the garden. Truer words may not have been spoken at the time. Indeed, if we're ever to live in peace and harmony, where we all desire to be and to live, if we ever desire to get back there and have that, we have to get back to the garden. And not any garden. The garden. We have to get back to the garden. You know, there was a time about 6,000 years ago. Robin Weber might remember, right? He gave me a hard time yesterday, and I said, I'm next. There was a time about 6,000 years ago when a man and woman lived in that garden that I'm talking about, that Joni Mitchell sang about, a magnificent and beautiful terrestrial paradise, a large garden. I don't know how big it was, maybe 10 square miles, 20, 50, 100 is all I know. It was in a place called Eden, and it was a beautiful paradise. It was theirs. They were given free access to it. They were welcome there. And they were actually brought there by the owner of that garden. No rent, no mortgage. It was free. Free of charge. The only thing he said, maintain it. Keep it up. Don't throw your gum wrappers around and, you know, trash the place. The owner often showed up and spent time with them, walked with them and talked to them about all sorts of things. He had tremendous knowledge and wisdom. There's nothing that he didn't know or understand. There was nothing that they could not ask him, that he could not help them with or guide them with. The garden of his seemed to be made especially just for them. It provided everything they could ever want or need. Sunny days, bright moonlit nights, full of stars. Did anybody go out last night? Did anyone do their assignment? I did. It was a beautiful moon, wasn't it? Air was pure and clean and crisp. There were lush grassy meadows and fields full of every kind of plant. Shady valleys, fragrant, colorful flowers bloomed continuously everywhere. A large river ran through it, streams and brooks, with the cleanest, filled with the cleanest and purest of water, cool and refreshing. Birds soared in the sky, singing as they do and squawking. We see those eagles and those hawks. Always that high-pitched squeal you hear. And the birds of the trees, they hopped around on the ground. They perched in trees. They had annoying habits of landing on their head or on their shoulder, singing their songs. And the trees were just full of every kind of fruit and nut that you can imagine, everywhere. It was just an amazing, amazing place. And on top of it all, there were animals of every kind just walking around, gentle and peaceful, grazing and resting in the fields and meadows, walking and running, skipping and a-hopping, as we say, climbing trees, playing and eating, all harmless, all tame. The man and the woman would often get a kick out of leaning against a tree in the shade, watching the animals just graze and roll around. You know how they do. Lions on their sides, their stomachs going up and down as they breathe and pant. Little cubs climbing over them, annoying them. It was a wonderful place. And I'm not positive, but I'm quite sure there wasn't a mosquito, a spider. I hate spiders. Or a stink bug around. I truly admire Robin Williams, because if that stink bug landed on me, I would have been screaming like a little girl and running at him. Well, no, I wouldn't, but I don't like bugs. Ask my wife. She's the bug killer in the family. The days and nights were never too hot or never too cold. It was just right. It was perfect weather. Listen, so perfect you didn't even have to wear any clothes if you didn't want to. Now, it's a beautiful day out here, but I suggest everybody keeps their clothes on. But you didn't have to there. It was just perfect. Amazingly, there was food everywhere to eat, free for the taking. It was like a Golden Corral buffet. No charge, only good food, wholesome food, great food, unlimited pickings. The trees of the fields, the forests, were all heavy with fruit and nuts, ripe and juicy. And if you looked around, and you didn't have to look far, there was tarragon and parsley and beets and potatoes. Sorry, my wife doesn't like beets. Sorry for mentioning that. She cringed over there, beets. Onions and leeks. Everything you could possibly want, every spice. Growing right out of the ground, you could pick them up and just eat them. It was paradise. As for the owner of the land, what can I say about him? What can I say about him? He's the nicest individual you'd ever meet or want to know. Smart, too. Again, he seemed to know everything about everything. You couldn't stump him. Not anything, even if you tried. You ask him how many light bulbs does it take to, da, 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 da. He always knew. He always knew. If you told him, how do you fight off a pack of clowns? He knew the answer. You go for the juggler, right? Mary told me that one. Thank you, Mary. He always had the answer to any question, though. No matter what he was asked, advanced math, science, he knew the answers and he could help. And from what I read about him, he enjoyed teaching them. He loved teaching them all of these things and watching them learn and grow and seeing them experience the world around them. Most likely he got a chuckle out of them, maybe a big belly laugh when they failed in trying to do something. You know, as they learn things, like don't run on wet moss. It's a good one. But when they learned about a woodpecker, what's that bird doing over here? He's banging his head in a tree. He must be crazy. This gardener got a kick out of that. But what was so great about him, although he knew everything, he let them work it all out for themselves. He didn't tell them everything. He let them work it out. He gave them the facts. He gave them the lowdown. Yet he let them choose what they wanted to do. He got a big kick out of that. This man who lived there, his name was Adam. You know who I've been talking about. And this woman, her name was Eve. I guess you can say they had it all. They had it all, but the cherry on top of it, was a very special offer for them. just for them. You see, right there in the very middle of that garden, there was a tree, a special tree, and they could eat from it all they wanted, and if they did, they would never, ever die. They could enjoy this paradise forever. Everything they had, all they could see, everything they could experience, real happiness, contentment, joy, abundance, they could have it and share it together forever. Forever. Them and their offspring and everyone who would come from them. And with this wonderful, kind, loving gardener also. They could have it forever. As wonderful as this story is that I've been telling you and illustrating, as wonderful as it is, it's almost also an unbelievable, tragic story. You know why? You know why? You see, that great offer, as great as it was, they turned it down. They turned it down. They turned it down. But it wasn't only taken from them when they turned it down, and it was. It was taken from everyone who ever followed them. You see, sin got a foothold into this world, as did death. And so death passed upon all men since Adam. All have sinned, we read in Romans 5:12. This was total death, not just a dying of the body. This was annihilation. This was what came into the world was mega death, a total annihilation, eternal death because of their choice, because they rejected that master gardener. We all know the story. It's called the fall of man, isn't it? It's called the fall of man. It's paradise lost. It's salvation spurned. Banished from that tree of life that was in the center of the garden forever. Forever. The garden was closed. That tree was cut off. Inaccessible. Gone to the shifting sands of time. If we have any hope at all, though, it's what Joni Mitchell cried out for. We are stardust. We are golden. We are caught in the devil's bargain. And we've got to get back to the garden. But we can't. We can't. You and I can't do that. We can't do that. How can we get back then when we don't even know where it is anymore? And if we somehow found it, we couldn't get in. You know why? There's two bouncers there at the door that you don't want to mess with. I mean, they're fearsome bouncers. I run into some bouncers, and these two you don't want to run into. We can read about them in Genesis 3:23-24. I'll be paraphrasing it. Genesis 3:23-24, and it says, the landowner, who was the Lord God, sent him forth from the Garden of Eden to till the ground from whence he was taken. He drove him out, and he placed at the east of the Garden of Eden cherubims and a flaming sword which turned every way to keep the tree of life. Now, angels are tough. You don't want to mess with Gabriel, Michael, especially Michael. They're tough. When Michael shows up, there's trouble. Gabriel's usually want to talk to you. But Michael, I don't know. I'll deal with Gabriel. But cherubims, these two, I mean, human-like, four faces, human, lion, eagle, man, four wings, human hands, wielding flaming swords. I won't try to get past them. That's a bad deal. I don't like eating spiders. They freak me out. I'm going to try to get past two cherubim? I don't think so. So, you're saying, what does this all have to do with the Feast of Tabernacles? What does that have to do? It's a nice story. It's wonderful. We know this. We've heard this. But what does it have to do with the Feast of Tabernacles? Well, it has a lot to do. What I told you is not a fantasy. We know that. It's all true. Well, though tragic, though, it didn't end there, as we know. If it did, the Bible would be just a pamphlet. It would end somewhere in Genesis 4 or 5, and that's it. That's the end of the story. But it's not. There's more to it. It has a happy ending, and it's all in here. It's all in here, this whole book. It is possible to get back to the garden. Not that one. The owner, the gardener, closed it, and he began another one, a much better garden. We will get back there if we want to. I know that because it's been promised. It's been promised by a person, an individual, a God who doesn't lie, and will make it so. You see, although the terrestrial garden is lost to the sands of time, the tree of life in the middle was not lost. It was transplanted. It was moved to another garden. And those cherubim will not always block the path back to them. One day they will step aside and allow passage. The thing is, we can't get back to that tree. We can't gain access to the new garden on our own. We can't hitch some beat-up Volkswagen down the road to Max Yasker's farm. It's not there. We can't walk. We can't pay our way in. Those tickets aren't $18 anymore. They never were. We can't pay. First, you and I, we don't have enough dough, as they say. All of us together. We don't have enough money to buy those tickets. It's too expensive. They're priceless. The only way into the new garden is by permission, by invitation. The master gardener needs to welcome us and call us in, because he's God. And he said in John 6:44, about God, about him, no one can come to me except the Father draws him. You can't come into that garden where he is, where he dwells, where he wants you to be, unless the Father calls you in. It's the only way in, by permission, by invitation. We need to get the ticket to the garden. We need to get a ticket. The master gardener gives it out. That ticket to paradise. That priceless ticket that, by the way, is not for sale. You can't go to telecharge and buy it, even if you did have the money, which you don't. We need a map to find a route there. You don't know where it is. I don't know where it is. I mean, we do. We don't know the road to get there without a map. This, again, is the map that's given to us. But we can get tickets. Even though they're too much, the gardener has a whole barrel full of them, unlimited amount of tickets that he's handing out. That he's handing out to those that he wants to hand it out to. And he wants to hand them out to everybody. But everybody according to his time and planning. He doesn't want everybody rushing the gate and knocking down the fences. There's order and there's decency and a way, a process, to get into that. They still put that here from last year. To get in. There's a way to get in and a process, step by step. And he gives some tickets. So they can come in. He gives some more tickets. But I guarantee he's going to give every one of those tickets out, and there's enough there to give to everyone who's ever drawn breath on this planet. It's an unlimited barrel of tickets. Although that original garden failed to exist some 6,000 years ago, the owner is still around. The owner is still around. So too is another one, another garden that he's planning on making soon. A supersized garden, an upgraded garden, if that is even possible, that will accommodate everyone, not 50,000, not 500,000, but everyone. That's how big that garden is. not just two people. And if you want to know a secret, he's even got another one beyond that that he's working on, still with his Father. And in that one, everyone will come to. You'll hear more about that on the eighth day. That garden, what's ahead, where we're told in 1 Corinthians 2:9 that eye has not seen nor ear heard. The things that are waiting for us in that garden and waiting for everybody. Today and for the next 6 days, God's people all over the face of the earth have gathered together to worship the Lord of all creation, to rejoice, to become one as a community, like we're doing here, like we're doing around the popcorn pot. I discovered a new parable last night. The kingdom of heaven is like a kettle of popcorn. You put the oil in and drop a bag of corn in, and before you know it, it grows till it fills the pot and overflows. And everyone can experience some of that popcorn. You see, we're here to learn those things and laugh and enjoy each other and get to know each other and love one another. That's what the gardens are for. He wants so much to bring us back to the garden. These days that we're observing today, these days, these holy days, are the days that tell us how we can and will be brought back into his garden. They are the maps, and they're the only maps that reveal the route and the path to paradise back to life, real life, back to where we belong, where humanity belongs. Mr. Webb has stole all my scriptures, and so I won't go there, but I do want to turn to Leviticus 23, because, and I thank him for doing that, because he brought it out very eloquently, perhaps better than I can, as particularly verse 43 is the one that I wanted to point it out. After all the holy days are listed, and it says, these are my holy days, he names them all, he says you're to keep them, etc., and then in verse 43, there's a P.S. because he's already listed all the holy days, and he said, these are them to keep. And it's like, oh, by the way, P.S. also. And he goes right back again to that last holy day, the Feast of Tabernacles. And he says, why are you to keep these things? That your generation, everyone who comes after you, may know that God, eternal, made the children of Israel to dwell in booths. I sent them out. To tell your children. That's why you're to do this. That's why we're here. So we can tell our children, our relatives, our friends, our families. Why do you do that? Why do you go there? Why are you sitting out with a bunch of strangers burning popcorn in a kettle? Cold and chilly. Getting smoke in your eyes. Why are you in Walnut Creek of all places? Why? Trying to get back to the garden. That's where he sent us. That's where he brought us. He brought us here. You think you came here on your own? Because of your own money? Because of your own wealth? Or because you decided? No. He gave you a ticket. He showed you the way. He gave you the maps. And he made promises to you. And you, by the grace of God, are here. And have come here. So that you can tell others in the future, in an eternity, why you came here, why you're here. He brought us here. He brought Israel out of Egypt. He destroyed that nation, one of the most powerful nations of the age at that time. He did it. And he brought them out into the wilderness for a wilderness experience where he could work with them on their way to another garden called the Promised Land. And you know what? For 40 years... he was with them, feeding them, clothing them, giving them shade in the sun, heat at night, food every day. Of course, they weren't cannolis. I know. Yes, I had to go there. But it was manna, and that's good, too, if you like that stuff. But for 40 years, he protected them, watched over them. The only ones who didn't get into the Promised Lands are the ones who didn't want to. and complained and rejected the offer. But everyone else did. 40 years. 40 years. I'm not even 40 years yet. That's a long time. 40 years. He did it. And he says, down the road, when they say, why are you doing this? That God had our back for 40 years. He destroyed a powerful nation, as he will do again. You know, a lot of us came here. Some of us don't know if we'll have jobs when we go back. Some of us, maybe we're the only one here in our family, and we left things back there in turmoil and chaos, but we came anyway. He brought you here. He gave you the ticket to his garden, and you got up and you went, just like Moses did, just like Aaron did, just like Elijah did. They all had wilderness experiences, and God worked with them. That's his workshop, and we're here today in his workshop, learning so we can tell others that it's the Almighty God, it's him that brings us to these places. He will do it. It will happen. The whole world will one day come to another garden. But that garden that they're coming to, they're going to help plant and seed. And we're going to be there helping them too, showing them the way, taking them from under the rubble of their cities and towns, giving them clothes to replace the rags and the blown up and dirty, filthy rags that they've come to be in, to give them food, because the world will be devastated when this new garden starts to get planted. And they'll learn and they'll grow, and it will become another paradise. It will be so for 1,000 years. Can you imagine 1,000 years of following the gardener's way? 1,000 years ago, it was 1023. There were no phones. There was no running water. There were no cars. There was no musical phones. Sorry about that. Lost my train of thought. I said, what song is that? Can you think 1,000 years in the future? We talk about that sometimes and we say, oh, you know, in the year 2065, it's going to be this. Oh, we're going to be half human, half people. There's going to be flying cars. That's only 100 years, we think, in the future. What about 200, 300, 600 years in the future? What will it be like? The world that those who come up at the end of the millennium will come into is not the world we live in today. Not remotely close to it. We don't know what that world will be like. Maybe there will be flying cars. I don't know. 1,000 years from now, God allowing us to invent and create and use the brains that he's given to us and innovate. Maybe we'll have cold fusion. I don't know. But we won't be making bombs out of it. We won't say, look at what I discovered. Now how can I kill half the planet with it? No, it'll be, look what I discovered. How can we use this to make our lives better and more? And the master gardener is going to be there laughing and chuckling and saying, that's nice, that's good. But we'll all be there. We'll all be there. Now, just before I started, John Miller came over to me and he said to me, don't you dare go 1 minute over. After he took 20 minutes talking about bass in his lake, he tells me not to go 1 minute over. Well, John, can I go a minute or two over? Thank you. I hope you don't mind. I'm wrapping it up, but this is far more important than bass. Now, we will all be there. There's a time coming when we'll all get back to the garden. The one that's coming in this wonderful world tomorrow that was just spoken of, and in the one beyond that too. He's still working day in and day out, that master gardener and his father, who's even a greater gardener than him, are working. They're working to bring us back into his garden, his paradise, and to that tree that's still there waiting for us all. That's why we're here today, to know that he's going to do it. He did it for Israel out of Egypt. There's not a nation on the face of the earth. There's not a power that exists that can thwart his purpose and stop the garden that's going to be replanted and given to the whole world. If you turn over to Revelation 22:14, we read, "Blessed are they that do his commandments." See, when you have a ticket, on the back of the ticket, there are conditions. You know, you can't sell it, you can't do this. Well, the tickets are free, but there are conditions. There are conditions. He says, "Blessed are they that do his commandments." There's one of his conditions. "That they may have a right." I like that. That they may have the right. He gives us the right. To what? To the tree of life. "And they may enter in through the gates into the city." And I know you're not supposed to change scripture, but I'll paraphrase that. That they may have the right to enter into the gates of his garden, which is his city, his heavenly Jerusalem. Back up to verses 1 and 2. John says, "He showed me a river, a pure river of water, of life, clear as crystal, proceeding out of the throne of the Lamb. In the middle of the street of it, and on either side of the river, was there the tree of life." Did you see that? God's doubling down in the future. It's not the tree of life. There's two trees now on either side. As the Living Translation puts it, "On each side of the river grew a tree of life." It's even more of a blessing. It's wonder. It's awesome. "Which bare 12 manner of fruits and yielded a fruit on every month, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations." In Revelation 2:7, we all know this one. Revelation 2:7, "He that hath an ear, let him hear what the Spirit say to the churches." In other words, listen up, pay attention. This is important. Don't let it slide by. To him, another condition on the back of the ticket. To him that overcomes. And it's the gardener who enables us to do that even. "Will I give to eat of that tree of life." It's a messy fruit. It's so full of juice. And so tasty, when you bite into it, it goes down your chin. And you never see those kids with those messy faces? You don't want them even coming near you. They're all sticky. You got to go. It's so full of life and joy and wonder. We get just soaked with it. "That he will give the tree of life," which is in the middle of paradise, the middle of the paradise of God. "To him will I give a ticket to my garden. To him will I open the gate. To him will I make it happen." And to her. It's not unusual to hear many sermons on rejoicing during these days and on experience a taste of the wonderful world to come when Jesus returns, our Savior, the Son of God, and establishes his kingdom and replants his garden on the face of the earth. The wonderful world tomorrow, we call it. Take time during this festival to remember who's been working all of these years from day one to bring humanity back to the garden. Who's been working and delivering on his promises. Remember who made Israel to dwell in the tents and why he did it. To show his power and his glory. And so that we can look back and say, he keeps his word. He's going to do what he said. I'm going to make it into the promised land. I'll be back in his garden. Reflect on what he's doing with you. With you. Since he brought you out of spiritual Egypt. And all the magnificent journeys he's brought you on and delivered you from every single one of them. You're still here, aren't you? No one's taken you out yet, have they? No, they haven't. He will bring you to that garden. God will appear. His name is Jesus. His name is Jesus. He will rule on this earth. He will open the doors to a better way. And he, with us, everyone here, with us, will help the world plant a new garden from the rubble that was once this earth. A garden that will flourish and cover the face of the earth, a paradise. And one day, when all is said and done, he will open up the gates to his true, everlasting garden to all those who have ever drawn breath, who have ever lived, as it was in the beginning, so it will be at the end, from tree to tree, when we all get back to the garden.